what it's surprising to me. You know, when I was first starting to study this, I really had no idea of Julius Caesar's relationship to the Bible. Not that he has a direct relationship, but you read Shakespeare's mythical or fictional account of Julius Caesar, and in high school, I don't know if they still do that. I had to do it, did I have to do it or did I just read it for fun? I can't remember. Yeah. Yeah. Stone tablets. Good one, Mike. He's usually not that quick. So Julius Caesar, you know, I had no idea where he was. You hung his lifetime on the timeline of life in the Bible, and it turns out that he ends up dying in, I think it's 47 BC. I'll check my notes in just a second. On the Ides of March, everyone, you know, Caesar, beware the Ides of March. You know, March 15th. I had no idea of how the Roman Empire really related into. Joined into the Bible, except for what we see in Luke and Matthew and Mark. The thing is that the first triumvirate really sets the stage for what we're going to need. Remember, we're always talking about the fullness of time. The fullness of time, these guys are really important as far as the fullness of time, because not as much as what they do is what they set the stage for. They're going to set the stage for what we're going to read about today or talk about today, and that's the second triumvirate, which will end up actually ending the last man standing in the first triumvirate was Julius Caesar. The last man standing in the second triumvirate is Octavian, Gaius Julius Caesar, or Octavian, who we know as Augustus. And the reason that's important for the New Testament is because when Gaius Julius Caesar, Augustus, came into power, he actually reformed a corrupt republic. The republic at that point in time, and I made this kind of hinted at this comment last time, the Senate, the senators, were all about making themselves rich and not doing what's best for the empire. And I kind of made the off comment that seems like what's happening in our country today, is that they don't really, they're always thinking about getting reelected nowadays as opposed to doing what's best for the country, and doing what's best is not always popular. And so the senators in this time were the same way. And Caesar, as soon as he got into office as dictator, started making some reforms. And he was murdered. And because of that, his reforms weren't fulfilled. However, when Augustus gets into power, he's going to make some of the same types of reforms, and we're going to end up with a period of peace in the world that's not been seen for many, many, many years. And under Augustus, that's called Pax Romana, the Roman peace, and that's going to set the exact stage for the birth of Christ. And so we really can't underestimate these guys, the first triumvirate's contribution to the Pax Romana, because it's out of this movement trying to reform the Roman Republic by making it basically a Roman Empire, trying to do that. And Julius Caesar was actually a good man. Now, his descendants are not necessarily good men. We'll see that when we get to Nero. And we'll talk about Nero at some point, just briefly, as we're moving towards the destruction of the temple. And then after, well, you've got Caligula and Nero. Both of them are Julian Caesars, and they're not... they're not good men. But these guys, Julius Caesar and Augustus, tend to be at least moral men, trying to do what's right for the empire as opposed to what's right for themselves, although the both seem to coincide. So Crassus and Caesar and Pompey. These guys, Crassus and Caesar, were really good friends. Caesar was kind of a student of Crassus, and Crassus was a wealthy businessman that Caesar, he ended up bailing Caesar out a number of times. Caesar goes out into the military to avoid his debts and ends up becoming a great general. He did it later in life, actually, and when he was when he went into the military, and you can buy positions. And that's basically what Crassus did for him, is bought him a position. And he ended up becoming quite the general. That it's actually such a surprise that he was so good a general, because he had never really thought about it before that. But modern day people, historians consider him one of the greatest generals ever. He was able to bring about a peace between Crassus and Pompey. Pompey was, and Crassus were not friends. Pompey, as I mentioned, took credit for putting down the Spartacus rebellion, when actually it was Crassus who did most of the fighting. Pompey just swooped in at the end and took credit for it. That didn't really help them at all, but Crassus is actually not a general, he's a businessman. But you can buy that sort of thing. So because he was a general, he started, he actually went out to invade Parthia, the Parthian Empire, and was easily killed. He and all of his troops just about were killed in Parthia. Now, Parthia is we'll see it on a map later, but the Parthian Empire is pretty much what the Median Empire used to be. It's the part of the Seleucid Empire that doesn't involve Asia Minor. When the Seleucids lost Asia Minor, they also lost the rest of that Alexander the Great's empire, and the power vacuum was the Parthians came up, and Parthians are actually going to be we don't really read about it in the Bible, but the Parthians are responsible for another coup that happens in Jerusalem a little bit later that involves Herod the Great. So these guys again, Crassus dies, and Julius Caesar is planning to go invade Parthia before he gets killed, and actually Octavian's going to go take up that mantle in a little while. So these guys are again important to our story, because they're setting the stage for these guys down here. This is when he dies in Parthia. So you can see Syria right here. Jerusalem's down here. This is, again, part of the... This would be Asia proper. This is Asia Minor over here. And he's going to follow some troops into the desert, and they're going to surround him, and they're just... After 3 days, they just keep wiping him out. Anyway, Crassus... You want to hit the button for me, Carl? Or not. Well, yeah, it doesn't go at the wall, though. The thing's back there. Hey, Carl, hit the right arrow. He said he is hitting the right arrow. Let me find out where we are in my notes. We have a new computer back there. Let's see. The death of Crassus, again, opened the way for a rupture between Caesar and Pompey, and Pompey is going to actually lose that fight. Ah, okay, thank you. Here we are. That's where we want to be. Pompey's going to lose the fight. Herod's father, Antipater, is going to back Pompey against Caesar. But when Pompey gets defeated, he's actually going to go and supply Caesar with food, and he's laying siege to Alexandria. Caesar's grateful for sending army and supplies to Caesar, and he makes him a Roman citizen and procurator of Judea. Hyrcanus II, and we'll see that picture again later, is made high priest and a Roman senator. And Lauren pointed out that this actually is another one of those in the fullness of time things, because Caesar grants them special religious privileges. He allows them to worship God in their own way, and he gives them basically an exemption that's followed through all the way to Nero, and allowing the Jews and not only the Jews, the Christians, which are thought to be the Romans think as an offshoot of the Jews, allows them to worship safely. And so it allows the spread of Christianity early Christianity until the time of Nero when they start persecuting him. In 47 BC, Antipater made his son Phasael governor of Jerusalem and his son Herod the governor of Galilee. And he's 15 or 16 at that time, and Herod's going to start going out and hunting down freedom fighters and bandits and stuff like that. And it's on March 15th, 44 BC, that Caesar is assassinated in Rome. And Cassius and Brutus raise up an army in support of the Republic, and they're opposed on the other side by these guys. Marcus Lepidus, Octavian, who's actually now Gaius Julius Caesar, which is the same name as Julius Caesar, Octavian, and Mark Antony, or Marcus Antony, or Marcus Antonius. We know him by Mark Antony. That after Caesar's death, a new triumvirate is going to rise up based on Caesar's closest supporters. Now, we've got Gaius Octavius, who's named as Caesar's sole heir in his will, and he's going to change his name again to Gaius Julius Caesar, and we know him better as Augustus Caesar or Octavian. Mark Antony was Caesar's right-hand man, as far as one of his major generals. When he was in Gaul defeating all those people, Mark Antony was one of his generals. And in fact, Mark Antony was in Rome when Caesar was assassinated, but they barred him from going into the Senate with Caesar, knowing that he would try to defend him. It was Brutus or Cassius, I can't remember which one, who as part of the agreement to assassinate Caesar, kept Mark Antony alive. So they kept him out of the Senate so that wouldn't happen. Mark Antony is an able general, and we'll see that later. Octavian is young at this time. He's like 20 years old at this time. Not very old, but he's already experienced in politics and stuff like that. Lepidus, on the other hand, Marcus Lepidus, some people think he's the weakest link of this, but he was also one of Caesar's most trusted lieutenants. And when Caesar goes out to fight Pompey, he actually leaves Lepidus in charge of Rome. He names him his master of horse. But he leaves him in charge of Rome. So he's got the utmost trust in Lepidus and Mark Antony. And, of course, then you've got Octavian. The three of these guys are going to get together, and they're going to go after Cassius and Brutus. And if you've ever read Caesar, you know that there's a big battle scene in which Octavian's army and Antony's army go against their army. And you think about this, you've got Romans fighting against Romans. It would be like having the east half of the United States fighting the west half of the United States, with the National Guard troops or something like that. You've got the best equipped army in the world fighting each other. And these guys go into battle with, they said, 19 legions, which is a lot of men. Isn't there 5,000 men in a legion or something like that? 6,000? So 19 legions, you do the math. And it says that they had 33,000 cavalrymen. So they're going into battle against Brutus and Cassius. And I think I have a map here. So this map shows us a little bit, and you probably can't read this part down here, but this red part here is the part that's claimed by Brutus and Cassius. They leave Rome almost immediately, and the red that you see up here is Brutus and Cassius. They've claimed that part of the world, and you've got Lepidus over here taking this part of the empire, which is Spain, and this part up here is taken by Mark Antony. This part here is taken by Octavian. And so this you see that the empire is pretty much splintered at this time, and we're actually going to have a civil war. And we're just doing this to get to the point that eventually this is all going to settle out into a long-term peace. But so over here, this is actually, where is it? I don't think you can see it. Yeah, it's right here. Philippi is right here. Philippi is named after Philip of Macedon. It's a city that he built. We know it from the Bible. It's one of the cities that Paul visits. Philippi is where a major battle is going to take place between the Brutus and Cassius and the forces of Antony and Octavian. Let's see. That's going to happen in 44 BC. Let's see. So Brutus and Cassius leave Italy and take control of all the eastern provinces from Greece to Syria and the allied eastern kingdoms, which are these guys over here. And there's Cappadocia, there's Galatia. So these are the eastern kingdoms. And let's see. And the rest of them are going to take control of the west. They crush the opposition in the Senate and establish the second triumvirate. And their first act is going to be to try to destroy the liberators' forces to avenge Caesar's death, and that's going to happen at the Battle of Philippi. Cassius is going to proclaim himself proconsul of Syria, and in doing so, he's actually going to put Antipater, who's an Idumean, in charge of Israel, and Cassius is going to begin to raise an army to fight the Second Triumvirate. Antipater was given the task of gathering money needed for the project, and when you gather money like that, when you don't use good tactics, what happens to you oftentimes? You get killed, and that's exactly what happened. Antipater was poisoned. A man named Malichus was trying to posed as a friend of Antipater and trying to seize the government for himself. So Antipater, Cassius names Antipater governor of this area here, or proconsul of that area there. Make sure it's, he named him proconsul. And then he gets killed raising taxes and money for Cassius. That's going to come into play a little bit later when we get to Herod, because usually when you're on the losing side of a battle, you get punished for it, but Herod actually talks his way out of getting punished for it. So it's his father that's raising an army and all that. So the Battle of Philippi, again, the combined forces of Antony and Octavian meet Brutus and Cassius at Philippi. Over 2 days they fight. Antony's going to attack Cassius, and Brutus is going to attack Octavian. Antony's going to mostly win against Cassius. Cassius is going to be mistaken, though. It's like when Darius III was in battle with Alexander and thought he was going to lose. He withdrew. Well, these guys don't just withdraw. If they think they're going to lose a battle, they oftentimes commit suicide, and that's what Cassius did. He thought he was going to lose the battle, and he committed suicide. And so Antony ends up winning soundly there. Brutus actually beats Octavian and makes it as far as Octavian's tent, and they suggest that Octavian actually hid in the swamps to get away from it. But what ends up happening is that Antony and Octavian regroup and go against Brutus now, and history tells us that Brutus is not the smartest bulb in the bunch as far as military tactics. It was Cassius that was the military leader, and so Brutus does not succeed in the second battle. It happens over 2 days, not over one, and I don't imagine that a ghost visits Brutus in his tent, but like Shakespeare says, but that's all for drama. Antony ends up winning, and his success clearly makes him the foremost member of the Second Triumvirate, and Octavian's is going to return to Rome. So that leaves us with this picture. Ah, good. So now you've got Octavian in charge of all of this area here after Lepidus is asked to step down. And over here you've got Mark Antony in charge of all of this. And do I have another map here? No, I don't. What we're going to see later on, that there's going to be a dividing line here between the forces of Octavian and Mark Antony. So meanwhile in Judea, Antipater raising the army in support of Brutus and Cassius is poisoned. And again, it would have put the Jews on the losing side, opposite of the Second Triumvirate. When Cassius and Brutus are defeated at Philippi, Herod convinces Mark Antony that Antipater was forced to raise an army against his will. That they were really Rome's friends. And in 41 BC, Antony makes Herod and Phasael tetrarchs of Judea. So that's going to put Herod in direct control of parts of Judea, as well as his brother Phasael. Now, before we had this little chart that ended right here, we had a different chart. This chart's a little bit different because we want to see this right here. Herod the Great's actually going to marry a Hasmonean. This is after the Hasmoneans have been, this is after these two guys are fighting about the Roman Empire, and Pompey comes in and puts all of Judea under Roman rule, still leaving this guy in charge. This guy eventually ends up being in charge. And we'll see that these two cousins marry, and one of the women that Herod marries. In fact, they suggest that he loved her most of all. So out of that marriage is going to come some more. We're going to see Herod's family tree a little bit later, and it's going to be really twisted. Because cousins keep marrying cousins, or uncles married daughters. It's not considered incest for an uncle to marry your daughter. So your brother to marry your daughter, it's not considered incest in Rome or in Judea at this time. If you go back to Leviticus, they're pretty specific in the way they do it. What's going to happen is that this guy is going to try to take over, and he's going to be somewhat successful. But let me get here. So Antigonus, this guy, is the nephew of this guy, and he's actually going to come in, and he's going to be backed by the Parthians we were talking about earlier. And he's going to capture Jerusalem, and he's going to cut off the ears of Hyrcanus. Now, if you're high priest, can you have your ears cut off? No, because you can't have any defect. And having your ears or mutilated in any way means that you can't be high priest. So he's actually doing that so that he can assume the high priesthood, but also so that this guy is basically taken out of power. So it makes him ineligible for the office of high priest. Phasael, who's in control of Jerusalem at the time, Herod's brother, kills himself, but Herod is going to escape, and he's going to sail to Rome, and he's going to ask for help. And he's going to tell how Antigonus welcomed the Parthians in, who are the sworn enemies of Rome. And Herod's going to sweet talk both Octavian and Antony, and he's going to be made king of Judea. And he's given an army of two Roman legions, and he lays siege to Jerusalem and captures it. So this is the time is 39 BC. Again, we keep marching down toward closer and closer to the birth of Christ. He's going to be in 39 BC. Herod, who's half Jewish, half Edomite, an Edomian, he's going to be made king of the Jews. And so he marries Mariamne, who's the great granddaughter of Hyrcanus. And he does that for two reasons. One, because he likes her, but also because as an Edomian, he's not well received. He's only part Jewish. The Edomians were forced to convert by John Hyrcanus up here. He went into the area that they lived in and force him to convert to Judaism, and it was actually his father who was supporting Hyrcanus. Antipater was supporting Hyrcanus and his advisor, and it's his sons, one of Herod and one Phasael, but he's marrying into this family so that he can have prestige. These guys are well liked for the most part. They are royalty, and he's going to marry into that family so that he has more legitimacy in his rule. And he apparently really loves her and has two children by her, but his sister, we don't have her on this chart. His sister is actually going to conspire with her mother, Salome Alexandra, and actually they suggest that she was forced to conspire against her to get Mariamne killed. And if you were here in the old building when Tim Hale came and talked about her, he actually embalmed, he loved her so much that he had her embalmed in honey. And he made the joke that's if someone calls you honey, that's where it came from. But he said, apparently loved her so much that he would have servants go through the house calling out her name as if she were still there. So Herod, as he's going through here, he's becoming more and more mentally unbalanced. He's becoming more and more paranoid. And apparently Mariamne heard that Herod was going to kill her for whatever reason. And so she stopped sleeping with him. And that's when his sister swoops in and says that she was guilty of adultery. And so he put her to death for that. They had a trial and put her to death for that. Now, his sister made a tactical error, and her name is Salome. Salome the First. She's the chief witness against Mariamne, and she's going to make the mistake of declaring herself queen and saying that Herod is mentally unbalanced, and Herod's just going to have her put to death. So it was actually a grab for power by Herod's sister, and it didn't end well for her. Last week we had said something about Herod when he was in Galilee. The Sanhedrin tried to bring charges against him. When they did that, Herod actually, instead of coming contritely to the Sanhedrin to answer the charges, he actually brought his army into the Sanhedrin with him and said, "Go ahead, make my day. You know, go ahead, say something bad about me." So he actually cowed the Sanhedrin at that point. Now that he's in charge, he's actually going to go and kill 42 of them. So almost over half of the Sanhedrin he's going to kill because of what they said against him earlier. So Herod is actually quite vicious in his rule. And as we see this, it doesn't surprise us that he would go to the lengths of having all the children that are two, all the boy children in Bethlehem, two and under, killed later on. So he's more and more unbalanced. When we get down to the end, he's going to change his will a number of times right at the end, but I believe Alexander's his oldest son. He was supposed to follow Herod, but Herod is so paranoid that he thinks that Alexander is conspiring against him, so he puts him in prison. And when Herod's on his deathbed, he tells his men to go out and kill a whole bunch of Pharisees, a whole bunch of the Jewish leaders, because Herod himself is not liked. The people hate Herod. Even though he's done all these nice things for him, like build him a temple and do all this, they hate him. And so when he gets to his deathbed, he says, "Well, if they're not going to mourn for me, they're going to mourn for their own leaders." And so he actually tells his men to go out and kill all these Jewish leaders. Thankfully he didn't, but they didn't follow it. But one of the commands that they did fall out is that they killed Alexander. So Herod on his deathbed, he's basically insane by that point in time, and he has his oldest son and heir killed so that he can't assume power, because earlier on he thought he was trying to overthrow him. So again, we can see that Herod is not the best guy. He didn't want to really be a friend of Herod's because eventually it would come back and get you. Go ahead, Mike.
Something I reflected on before, and I really never came to a firm conclusion, was, you know, Christ used the example of a man who was forgiven a great debt, and then, mm-hmm. you know, he goes out and he's not forgiving, and he starts to demand from his servants and won't accept and forgive them. Herod kind of fits that picture. I mean, here early on, he was forgiven and allowed to live, you know, and yet he becomes so ruthless and bloody that there's no forgiveness in his life at all. So it's just kind of, I've almost wondered if Jesus was reflecting on that at all.
It's possible. Of course, we don't know. One of the things about Herod is that he was a very astute politician. He actually sided with Mark Antony. In the battle of Octavian versus Mark Antony, he sided with Mark Antony. And when Octavian comes down, and Octavian does come down through Syria to go to Egypt to get Mark Antony and Cleopatra, after the Battle of Actium, he's actually headed towards there when Cleopatra and Mark Antony both commit suicide. When he gets to Herod, Herod basically goes to Octavian and says, "Yes, I was a supporter of Mark Antony. And as good a supporter as I was to him, I will be that good of a supporter to you." And it was a gutsy move. And normally in that situation, Herod would have been taken out of power and he would have been shunned. But Octavian was impressed by his guts and his verve, I guess, if you want to say. And he kept him on as king of the Jews. So he was an astute politician. It's just that he had mental problems towards the end, thinking that everyone was trying to kill him. And that may not be far from the truth, that everyone was trying to kill him. But he also had several gross diseases, as I understand, one involving worms and some other stuff. But Herod could have contributed to his insanity. And, you know, there's another thing that we overlook sometimes, especially like when you get to the Middle Ages and the kings and queens of Europe, is they didn't know what lead poisoning was. They would have cups and stuff made out of lead. And all of that. And it's not. I wouldn't put it past that to cause a lot of the insanity that we see in the Bible and in history, because these people had no idea. If you look at what lead does to the body, lead poisoning does to the body, it really does make it does disconnect your mind from reality. It can cause hallucinations. It can cause all sorts of things. And so, it's quite possible that these guys, it might have been as simple as lead mixed into the glaze of a drinking cup or something like that. Which, if you think about it, that happened even up to our. It was when I was a kid when they said, stop eating paint. No, stop painting with paint because your kids might eat it or something like that, you know. So you don't find lead paint. Now, the thing is that if you go look back at what lead did to paint, it made paint better. That's why they put lead in paint in the first place, is because it made it stronger. It made it last longer. It made it nicer. The colors were more vibrant. And you go look at, if you look at glazes that they use in pottery, they've replaced lead for the most part. But you go back further in time, if you're not going to use it, like my daughter does this stuff sometimes. She used to do this stuff called raku, which is especially fired. They use lead in those glazes because you know it's not going to be used for eating. And it makes the colors just really pop and stuff like that. So it wouldn't surprise me if lead poisoning had something to do with the insanity that we see at these points in time.
A whole family that had become sick, and it turned out that they were using a ceramic pitcher and serving orange juice from it.
Oh, yeah.
And the acid in the orange juice and the citrus was leaching the lead out at a higher percentage, and they made it very sick.
Now, it's funny, but poor people don't usually have this problem because they weren't even eating with that. They'd have a wooden bowl or something like that, as opposed to something that was made. Pewter, I believe, is a mixture of silver and lead. And you hear about pewter stuff all the time in Middle Ages. Go ahead, Jeff.
Also, you talk about Herod the Great or Herod Antipas at the moment?
Herod the Great. Antipas is going to have his own problems.
Right. With Antipas being rebuked by John the Baptist for his gross immorality,
yeah.
You know, a lot of these world leaders, even nowadays, wind up going slowly insane.
Which might also play into what Mike was saying, as far as Herod had kind of a strange disease with worms and stuff, and that might have played into it too. You're right. A good point. So anyway, at this point in time, Octavian has basically forced Lepidus into retirement. And the nice thing about it is that he let him live. So he actually, in most of these kind of purges where someone's trying to consolidate power, which Octavian was trying to do in the west part of the empire, in fact, I think I have this. This land, which used to be controlled by Lepidus, Octavian actually wants. And Octavian's going to take it from him, and he's going to force him into retirement. One of the last things Lepidus does is he's the last Pontificus Maximus, which is the last high priest of Rome, a separate one of after Augustus. Actually, it's going to the Caesar is going to be Pontificus Maximus. He's going to be the high priest of Rome as well. So Lepidus goes into retirement. And Octavian basically has the entire west half of the Roman Empire, and the east half of the Roman Empire is ruled by Mark Antony. At this point in time, Mark Antony is married to Octavian's sister, but that does not stop him from marrying Cleopatra and having this long love affair with Cleopatra. So just, we kind of skipped over the whole Caesar-Cleopatra thing. Caesar actually met Cleopatra and fell in love with her, and possibly, they think, fathered a child by her. And Mark Antony actually fathers twins by her. That would be Ptolemy Philadelphus and Alexander Helios. And you can see, and there's another daughter in here, Cleopatra Selene. And so what he does, they get together in Mark Antony, and they agree that this will be how this section of the empire is set up. The problem is that Cleopatra, if she did have a son, Caesarion, by Caesar, Mark Antony and Cleopatra together decide that they want to push his claim to the actual being the actual heir of Julius Caesar as opposed to Octavian. And it's going to be that's going to make Octavian mad, because he can't have another heir claiming the throne that he's got. And so they're actually going to go out and fight. And they're going to fight in the Battle of Actium, which is actually going to take place right in this area right here in the Ionian Sea. It's on that side, not that side. So that brings us actually to the Battle of Actium, which is kind of a specific changing point in this war. Mark Antony is going to go up against the fleet of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Those are these right here in purple, are going to go up against Octavian's fleet, and that's these here in red. And we could talk about the battle quite a bit if you wanted to, but we're not going to. But this is what's important right here, is that Cleopatra's fleet, the Egyptian fleet, was held in reserve. They were in the background just waiting to see how the battle was going to go, and if they were needed, they were supposed to come in. The battle here did not start going well for Mark Antony. And it wasn't completely over, or wasn't completely, they had not lost, but Cleopatra, thinking that they were losing, decides to take her entire fleet and leave the battlefield. When she starts leaving the battlefield, Mark Antony actually sees her, and he gets off of his flagship onto a smaller ship, and he leaves as well, because she's fleeing, so he flees. And because of that, the rest of Antony's fleet basically gives up, because here's their king, basically, and he's leaving because his girlfriend's leaving, and gives up. He gives up the battle. That's exactly what happens. Cleopatra is afraid that they're going to lose the battle. So they end up going down. They end up going down into Egypt. And what happens after that is that Cleopatra is afraid she's going to get caught. So it's almost like Romeo and Juliet, where Juliet takes the sleeping draught, right, to pretend that she's dead. That's what Cleopatra sets out a rumor that she's killed herself. When Antony hears that, he stabs himself to death. When she hears it, she poisons. She actually has a snake biter, an asp, and kills her. And so both of them basically commit suicide. And that's not to say that Octavian wouldn't have killed him eventually. When Octavian's going to go through here, he's going to go around. Let's see, I'll go back. He's going to go from there. He's going to go around down here to get Antony and Cleopatra. He's actually going to go through, and I've got a slide for that out of Daniel 11. He's going to go through the Holy Land. In my opinion, he's the king of the north that doesn't regard women, doesn't regard who worships a god of fortresses and stuff like that. That's, in my opinion, that's Octavian. Because I don't think it just stops there with Antiochus Epiphanes. He's going to come through, and he's going to go here, and that's when he'll find that they're dead. And at that point in time, he's going to rule the entire Roman Empire. His main challenger is dead. He's going to go back, and he's going to force the Senate into submission. He's going to name himself dictator. He's going to name himself Pontificus Maximus. He's going to assume the role of emperor, and the Senate is going to give him the title Augustus, which means basically like God on earth. And they confer deity to him, and they'll do that to the Caesars after him. They actually, almost all of them had the title Augustus at one point, but it's actually going to be Octavian that becomes Augustus. And at that point in time, again, super important to the New Testament because there's going to be a time of peace now for almost 80, 90 years. Octavian is going to make peace with the Parthians diplomatically. He doesn't actually do it with a battle. They're going to keep their part of the empire, which is this area over here. They're going to keep all of this to themselves. He's going to keep this part. And we've got the Rome, we've got the roads, we've got the communication, the language, we've got all of that, and in peace. And in that point in time, that's the fullness of time, and Jesus is going to be born. Go ahead, Ed.
During this peaceful time, he was so popular that they named a month after him, and they changed the name of the month that now is August. It's named after him. They changed it because of his popularity.
Well, just like July is named after Julius Caesar, right? But that's quite possible. October, of course, is named after the number 8. November after 9, right?
It'd have to be, if you're going to name a month after something, yeah, it's going to have to be popular around the world from it.
Right. That's quite possible, Ed. If you've ever heard of Pax Romana, that's talking about the peace that Augustus created, and he's going to want to tax all these people, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But the reason for the census that Joseph and Mary had to go to from Nazareth to Bethlehem for was because they needed to be counted so that they could be taxed. And that's the whole purpose. And he actually did 3 or 4 major censuses like that. And we'll talk about that more when we get to the end of this. But let's talk about Herod for a little bit. One of the things that Herod did this is supposed to be what Herod. That almost looks like a third eye right there, but I think that's supposed to be a mole or something. But it's not an eye. This is supposedly Herod here on the right. This is supposedly Herod there, and the two look really nothing alike. But that's not always unusual. Maybe different artists' interpretation. I didn't find any other corroboration that this was Herod, the bust. I searched the internet for all these pictures. You would think that Herod would have more images of himself. However, he might not have, because that would have been considered idolatry by the Jews. So this is supposedly Herod. For all I know, it could be Josephus, but it says Herod over here. And so I don't know if this is a Middle Ages woodcut or whatever, but this is supposedly what he looks like. Here's his simplified family line, or family tree. He has 4 main sons here, and it doesn't have Alexander on here because he's going to kill Alexander. When Herod the Great actually dies, it's Asterbulus that's going to take over, and he's going to rule for only a short time before he dies and Archelaus is actually going to take over for him. And that's when, if you go back to the New Testament, when Joseph is in Egypt because they're fleeing Herod, he's going to come back when he hears of Herod's death, but then he's told in a dream not to go back because Archelaus is in charge, and Archelaus is not very nice either. And so that's when he goes up to Nazareth. We've got Herod Agrippa here. And Agrippa the Second. Now in Acts chapter, do I have it in my notes here? It's in 26, I think, when it says that Herod and Bernice come down from Jerusalem to meet with Festus and Felix. Sorry, Felix and Drusilla. Felix and Drusilla, they come down to hear Paul's argument. And it might be 22. I might be misstating that. Well, it says 24 here, but she's actually not his wife. She's his sister, but also suggests that she's also his lover. So Bernice and Agrippa, these are the two guys that come down to meet with Felix and Drusilla and talk to Paul. So this is his simplified family tree, and this is the more complex one. because you've got here you've got him marrying a woman named Doris, a woman named Cleopatra of Jerusalem. You've got him marrying Mariamne. He marries Mariamne. Oh, Mariamne the first, Mariamne the second, and Malthus. So you've got all his wives on here, and you've got several of his sons. You've got his. It just gets all messed up when you start looking at who's marrying whom, because one of his daughters ends up marrying his uncle or his brother. It's so confusing when you get to it, and it's. The way it goes in all these families, they want to kind of keep it in the family as far as power and all that, so they end up marrying off each other. But it ends up being kind of a messed up thing. You can go, if you want to read some interesting stuff, go read about Herod's life, because it's really kind of a patent place of Jerusalem. But Caesar, in order to please the Jews, he's going to take on several huge building projects. He's going to repair the wall of Jerusalem. He's going to build a citadel to guard the temple, which is going to name the Fortress Antonia, and I'll show you a picture of that, or at least a picture of what they think it looks like. He's going to name it Antonia in honor of Mark Antony. He's going to mint coins bearing his own name, and following the earthquake in 31 BC, he's going to rebuild the Marcus theaters and a palace. So this is Caesarea Maritima. He's going to actually build this city from scratch. And he's going to make it, as you can see, it's a very Romanesque city or a very Greek city, but you've got a hippodrome over, or this is a theater. This might be the hippodrome. I can't remember which one it is. A hippodrome is a place for horse racing and stuff like that. Hippo meaning horse. It's going to have, but I think this is the theater instead. It's got all sorts of Roman buildings. He builds a man-made harbor here, and you can kind of see the ships all lined up and docked up in here. He's going to build a man-made harbor, and the cool thing is that some of that still exists. So here's the theater in that other picture. That still exists, and you can actually see part of the harbor here. And they actually went out and they built an artificial breakwater and everything and docks and everything out there. So he actually builds this. And he's going to name it Caesarea in honor of Augustus. Grecian-style grid of cities, piers, baths, aqueducts, a circus, and pagan temples. He's not above putting in pagan temples. He does that when he rebuilds Sebaste also. If my notes say that Herod was willing to support any religious group that exalted him. To fund his projects, he imposes a tax approaching 18%. Which is really high in an agrarian society. So in 20 BC, he's going to begin the Jewish temple, and he's going to make silly mistakes like try to put an eagle standard in front of it, which he ended up taking down. But despite all these grand things and all of that, he's going to still not be a loved guy. Let's see. He built a palace or two or three in different areas. This is his winter palace and what it's supposed to look like at Jericho. And you can look at all the details. It's got a hot room and a cold bath, and it's got all sorts of fun stuff in it. It's got a grand hall. I'm not sure where his apartments are in here, you know, where he's supposed to live in here. But this is his palace, at least a mock-up of it. He built a number of these. He built the Herodium, and this is what it looks like now, and this is what it was supposed to look like. This is basically a fortress, and he did this a number of reasons. Now, why would he build fortresses all over the place? Yeah, and Masada is also one of those, and I've got a picture of that. Why would Herod do that? Because he was paranoid. And if they wanted to attack him, he wanted a place to run to if he had to that could be easily defended. And so he's basically built, I mean, this kind of an area, how hard would it be to attack that if you've got, on top of that, you've got these walls? It'd be extremely hard to attack it. You know, he'd have easily be able to defend it. So he built the Herodium. He built, you know, those are some of his coins. He built the temple. Now, I'm sure that the temple didn't necessarily have this rainbow behind it. However, If it did, where's the sun in that picture, by the way? In the west, right? Because the door is faced east. But just trivia there. But however, what he did do, and it's kind of hard to see, this is all gold on the top, the column heads, all of that. Herod went to great expense to make this one of the most beautiful temples in the world. In fact, if you look over at... do I even have that in my notes? It's in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, 1 and 2. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him and to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone will be left here upon another that it shall be thrown down." So the temple is one of Herod's greatest achievements. And you can see kind of what's going on around it. There's a little bit of the Fortress Antonia behind it there. The thing about the temple, when we get to the destruction, you'll find out that Titus didn't really want to destroy the temple, but someone set it on fire, and all that gold that was all around it leaked down into the stones and stuff, and so they tore the temple apart trying to get the gold. Go ahead, Bill. Yeah, and you could see it for miles. The shining of it, you could see for miles. So pretty impressive stuff. It took over 40 years, some say as much as 80 years, to finally be completed. And I can imagine a cartoon moment where the guy is putting the final touch on the temple, and then Titus comes in and rips it down. That's pretty much what happened, is that they had the temple complete and finished for only a few years before Vespasian and Titus came and destroyed the temple. Pardon me?
Isn't there a passage in the New Testament that says, 40 and 6 years it took us to build this, and you're going to destroy this temple?
Right,
yeah,
right.
So yeah, I
figured
about 46 years.
Yeah, the reason I said 80 is because of they're suggesting some of the outbuildings and stuff. But they kept going at it long after Herod's death. Exactly right, though. Jeff?
Yeah,
I
just could see what you did.
That's a great image there. And at the time when Christ, you can just imagine Christ telling the Jewish leaders, destroy this temple, and I'll raise it up in 3 days.
Right.
And they say it's been 46 years of building, but they were only 2/3 of the way through.
Yeah.
They said keep going until it was 66 AD or something like that. And then they get to bask in it for years before it's torn down a little ground.
It's really kind of appropriate, you know, that this temple existed at this point in time. This is the end of the second temple. Herod's temple is actually, they remodeled the temple that was started by, that was finished by in Nehemiah's time. They remodel that and make it into this glorious temple. And it's into this that Jesus Christ is actually going to come. And Jesus makes the point, really, that the important part is not the temple. Right, it's not the gold. It's not the temple. It's not the gold that's blessed by the temple and all that. What's the important part here? Is not that the temple exists. It's that Jesus Christ comes to the temple. Go ahead.
That's another awesome point, Andrew. This is like a metaphor for everything that was important to the Jews. Everything that they cared about was the external appearance. Christ calling them white and sepulchre. You know, outside everything looks great the way you guys do it, and inside there's nothing but corruption.
Right. Right. So we're actually out of time. I just want to point out the Fortress Antonia here in this picture. We'll talk about that some because it's important. The Romans actually used that at one point in time. They're actually going to store the high priest's robes there and only let them out for special occasions and stuff like that. But we'll pick up there just a little bit more on his building projects. This is a model. I think it was at the Holy Land Hotel. We'll pick up there and then go on and talk about the census next week and the birth of Christ next week. So thank you for your time.